the Triathlon Show 400. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode we have another Q&A episode. This week the theme is gear and technology. Just as a quick reminder and a quick piece of housekeeping, I guess, if you're interested in asking questions for future Q&As, then the best thing to do is to sign up for the Scientific Triathlon newsletter on our website, down in the footer of the website to be specific, because I always put any requests for questions in the weekly newsletter, which usually comes out on Thursday morning European time. The other option is that you can follow us on Instagram and follow along in the Instagram stories, because I also put the request for questions there. However, of course, it's quite easy to miss an Instagram story because they disappear. So that's why I'm saying that the newsletter is probably the best option, because that one is easiest not to miss any requests for questions that I put out. But all right, before we get into this week's Q&A, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They help athletes perform at their best with electrolyte and fueling products and with free online tools, education, and a patented sweat test. You can use the free fuel and hydration planner on their website to get a personalized plan for your carbohydrate, sodium, and fluid intake. And you can also book a free 20-minute video consultation to chat through your plan with the athlete support team. I have used their entire range of products for a long time, and I think that they are absolutely brilliant. And you can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS23 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Senate. The Senate indoor swim trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency, even when you're short on time. It's a great tool for busy athletes because you can do a quality workout in just 15 minutes at home, even on days when you don't have time to get to the pool. It is a perfect complement to pool and open water swimming because it allows you to focus specifically on key aspects of your stroke, including your catch and your power, and you can isolate these aspects more easily than you can in the water. You can try the Zenate risk-free for up to 30 days, so if you don't love it, just send it back, and you can get 20% off your first order on zenatewintrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into this week's Q&A. The first question for today is from Bellum Tri Team, and the question is simply carbon fiber versus barefoot running. And I'm going to answer this question concisely. If you want to run fast, then carbon fiber shoes for sure. I don't know that there are any real benefits of barefoot running. I do like the thought actually of using barefoot shoes in the gym to make sure that you really work all the small muscles of the foot, work on foot stability. But in terms of running, the only real scenario where I would see barefoot running as barefoot running shoes as an option would be that you would still do all of your runs in normal running shoes, let's say, whether they be carbon fiber or not, but then finish one or a couple of runs per week off on a grass field with barefoot shoes to work on some mechanics, do some strides and so on. This is actually very theoretical, as I've personally never done this or even prescribed this. I've never used barefoot shoes nor coached anybody that used them, but that's the extent that I would go to with using or prescribing barefoot shoes, just some really short biomechanics focused work on the run. I think that the world has moved away from barefoot running shoes. They are a product of marketing hype from some 10 years ago or so, but I really don't think that there's from a running perspective any benefit of using them in running necessarily. That's the short and concise answer that I would give. The next question is from Vesa, who asks, crank versus a pedal-based power meter, what are the pros and cons of each? So I think that some people still see the crank-based power meters as gold standard, because this was the one way really that power could be accurately measured back in the day when power meters first came to market. These days, from my understanding and my knowledge, I think that pedal-based power meters have come so far that I don't really believe there is any relevant difference in accuracy or precision. And with that, I prefer, I much prefer pedal-based power meters because you can easily shift them between bikes. But also, and this is something a lot of people don't consider, when you size down in cranks, which I think a lot of triathletes should do, you don't have to buy new cranks with a power meter included, which would obviously be a lot more expensive than just going to a normal non-power meter crank of a shorter size. So that is a big advantage, that you have the flexibility of easily changing crank length without having wasted your money on the crank-based power meter. Personally, I've used the Favedo Asioma power meters for years, and I love them. I've had zero issues with them. They are incredibly reliable and easy to use. So generally, that's what I recommend to any athlete that asks me. But I'm sure there are other pedal-based power meters and power meters in general that are also good. But yeah, I definitely think that pedal-based power meters with the flexibility they offer is, in my opinion, the way to go. The next question is from somebody who I've lost the name of. Sorry about that. But the question is, lactate application, when to measure and how does it work? So I guess I'm going to give a bit of a longer answer here. And I'm going to answer this question from the perspective of 99% of the triathlon population, if not more like 99.9%, rather than the top 0.1% fighting for Olympic golds and world championship titles. I think that for almost everyone, lactate testing within training, in your day-to-day training, is overkill. It's just a curiosity, but it's not something that I think makes you take better training decisions. If you have 10 to 20 bucks to spend on lactate strips each session you do and you find it entertaining, by all means, you can check your lactate after intervals. But is it going to make you faster than not doing it and just keeping your head screwed on and keep staying engaged in your training process? I personally don't think so at all. I think that one thing that is important to remember is that for every top athlete that you see being successful with a lot of lactate testing, there are counterexamples of another athlete having similar success without it. So even at the top level, I don't think it's necessary. Although at that level, I definitely think that I understand why you might want to use it, because there is a potential there for a marginal but important gain. Where I do think that lactate testing has great utility, however, even for amateurs and most, the 99% of the triathlon population, is in doing formal testing every once in a while to establish training zones and thresholds. So in a formal test like this, you would establish your first and second lactate thresholds, your LT1 and LT2, and you would get to know these in terms of where are they in terms of heart rate and power or pace, depending on if it's a bike or a run test, and also RPE. Never forget to also take note of RPE for each stage in a lactate step test. So this will allow you to set some training targets. So for example, in your low intensity training, you would want to make sure that you are below that LT1. It doesn't mean 1 watt below it, but it means that you have a big zone where your easy training, your low intensity training should be done, and where in that easy zone it is. That's more of a nuanced question that has a lot of different answer, and that's beyond the scope of today's discussion. Establishing LT2 is the one that a lot of people find the most interesting, because that is your quote-unquote threshold, or even your FTP, or a lot of people would equate it to the FTP. But I actually think that the LT2 is less important. It is still useful, but it is less important, because you can use alternative tests like critical power, critical speed, to assess that kind of boundary between the heavy and the severe intensity domain. So basically what that allows you to do in practice is that it sets the boundary or the range where below a certain range of heart rate or power or pace, you're clearly in the kind of steady state, high aerobic work range. And that's what we call quote unquote threshold training. And above that, you are clearly in a non-steady state. So that is the domain where you would do your high intensity training. Please note here that I'm talking about this. I talked about LT2 as a range, and this is important, because there's no point thinking that your threshold is at exactly 245 watts or 445 per kilometer or 7.38 per mile. There's no such accuracy or precision in these measurements, and there's also a threshold is really quite a bad word, because it's not as if things change dramatically when you go from just slightly below threshold to slightly above threshold. It is more of a phase transition, and I will link to an article by Dr. Mark Burnley about that. But either way, knowing your LT1 and your LT2 can be useful for these reasons, because it does establish more or less where are the phase transitions between these different intensity domains, the moderate intensity domain, the heavy intensity domain, and the severe intensity domain, or in more layman's terms, I would call it low intensity training, moderate intensity training, or threshold training, and high intensity training, or let's say VO2 max or interval training. So you could, if you wanted to, you could do formal tests to establish these thresholds and zones a few times per year even. But even if you do it just once per year, that's pretty good, because it does allow you to monitor your year-to-year progress. And also, the relationship between lactate and heart rate would generally stay fairly constant over the course of a year. So even if your speed or your power gets better at your LT1 or your LT2, so that's something that you can't keep training to the same speed or power levels necessarily throughout the year. But your heart rate is unlikely to change significantly unless you are very new to training. And the same goes for RPE. So having those calibrated would give you actually a calibration of heart rate and RPE to lactate that would last you for a fairly long time and be pretty accurate, even if it's many months later or even up to a year later. So the most important use of formal lactate testing like this, as I kind of alluded to already, is not to assess your LT2, but I think that LT1 is the more important one, just to make sure that your low intensity training is at the right level, so that you don't get it wrong and train too hard, being constantly at or above LT1, because that could be a really big obstacle for you to progress. Also, the reason that I think that LT1 is a lot more important to assess than LT2 is because we really don't have many good field tests to really accurately assess LT1. We have the torque test, which is pretty okay, but some people struggle with finding that useful or knowing exactly when they are huffing and puffing too much versus not. So I think that for LT2 we have better alternative tests like the critical power, critical speed tests, even a traditional FTP test would not be a terrible way to go about things. But for LT1, I think that's where we lack alternatives, and it's probably the more important parameter to know anyway. And the other reason that it's the more important parameter to know, especially for, let's say, amateur triathletes focusing on half and full distance triathlon, is that I think that from what I've seen, at least LT1 is a better performance predictor than LT2, simply because unless you're at the very pointy end and you're competing at the 7.3 distance, you will race much closer to LT1 than to LT2, so that would be the better performance predictor. Then the things change, of course. If your focus is the sprint distance, then your LT2 would be more important than your LT1, at least from a performance marker standpoint. And for an Olympic distance, this could also be the case, that LT2 is more important, but that would depend on how fast you are over the Olympic distance, because if you are completing it in 3 hours or above 3 hours, I would still think that LT1 is probably closer to the intensity that you're competing at rather than LT2. So I guess a question that I might get if somebody was now standing in front of me and following up on what I'm speaking about here is, well, why don't I need to do tests very frequently to make sure that all my thresholds are up to date all the time, or even indeed take samples during the sessions to make sure that I train at exactly the right intensity? And I think that it comes back a little bit to the fact that we're not talking about an exact science with your threshold is exactly this or that. And also, we're not talking about dramatic changes in your physiology when you go from just below a quote-unquote threshold to just above. Again, it comes back to those phase transitions that I mentioned. And I'm not aware of any evidence that compares training with lactate intensity control versus doing a similar training program, but just using the traditional metrics of RPE, heart rate, and pace or power, and not using lactate in day-to-day training. So I don't think any study has been done that has compared this. And it would be an interesting thing to see. Absolutely. I would be all over it if somebody conducted that study, but I don't think it exists. And just because some top-level athletes are doing it in training does not mean that it's absolutely, certainly the best thing for every amateur athlete to do as well. So I think that what should be a much bigger interest and concern rather than using lactate in your sessions should be, am I really good at using power, pace, and RPE and heart rate in my sessions? Am I really in tune with how my body feels at different levels and in tune to when changes occur, that a certain power suddenly starts to feel easier, or I can hold a certain pace for longer at the same effort, that sort of thing. And even when I first interviewed Olav Alexander Bu on this podcast, that was actually way before most people had ever heard of him, because Christian and Gustav were at that point still being coached by Adil Tvaitan. But one of his key pieces of advice for amateurs that he said was to become really good at the basic stuff. So understanding your power duration curve and your speed duration curve, understanding your RPE and those sorts of things. It was not about lactate use. And in fact, he has repeatedly said on this podcast and on other podcasts that for most amateur athletes, it does not make any sense to use lactate testing like they do in training. So, in summary, from my perspective, yes, doing formal lactate testing, I think, has value, even if you just do it once per year. The main benefit of this would be to establish how strong your LT1 is, and if this is something you need to improve on, let's call it you might have a weak aerobic base. Because for most listeners of this podcast, that will be a very crucial marker for the racing that you're probably doing. LT2 also has relevance for your training prescription and for as a performance marker. But with LT2, it is less important because we just have good alternative tests. And of course, I know I already said it, but LT1 is so crucial also because it really allows you to make sure that your low-intensity training is really low-intensity training and it's not too hard. And this is quite common in amateur athletes, and that is why I do think that formal lactate testing, while it is not necessary to be good, it can have quite some value. I do have one final caveat, though. If you do decide to do formal lactate testing and you do it in a lab, I think that a lot of labs provide these tests on autopilot in a very lazy way with no critical thinking or actual analysis. They run the numbers through an algorithm and spit out the results. And it is understandable that these algorithms and analysis tools exist when we talk about scientific research, because we have to make these threshold measurements objective when we're talking about scientific research. We just can't have them be eyeballing the curve and doing subjective analysis. But I think that for an individual, running the numbers through the algorithm is terrible, or it can be terrible at least, because it doesn't really give good results for all individuals. So actually the best way to establish where your LT1 is and where your LT2 is by simply looking at the lactate curve. And this is something that Mark Burnley and I discussed how to do in episode 330 when I interviewed him. But just as a short summary, LT1 would be the step just before the first inflection point in the curve. So the final step of that you test where your lactate is still at baseline, essentially, or before the first significant increase in lactate from baseline. And LT2 would be the step just before you have a second inflection point. So when my athletes, for example, go to a lab to do lactate testing, I always get the raw data and do the analysis myself. And this is something that I recommend everybody do, either do it with their coach or learn how to do it yourself. It's not super difficult, because in many cases, if you just use the result of the automatically calculated thresholds that the lab gives you, it makes zero sense at all on the individual level. And it pains me a bit to say that to have so many caveats with people doing lab testing, and that so many lab tests provide, in my opinion, really poor service in this way. The same would apply with with a ramp test and with gas exchange tests, because I am in general a fan of understanding your physiology better and doing these sorts of things. But it's just that some of these things that are done on autopilot and without critical thinking and analysis just can end up actually hurting the athlete more than helping them. So that's the thing that to be really aware of when it comes to if you are going to do some formal lactate testing. And actually, if you think that, yeah, I maybe could do lactate testing, but I don't know how to do the analysis and I don't have anybody that I would ask, then to be honest, it's not the end of the world to not do it. You can definitely use just a good old-fashioned common sense and just learn how to be really in tune with your body without any of these gadgets, really. So it's absolutely not the case that you're going to be at a disadvantage generally, but it is there are some interesting additional data points, I guess, that lactate brings you, can bring you, but it is not necessary to be a good athlete or to train optimally, I don't think. The next question is one that I'm going to answer really quickly. Again, I lost the name of who asked this, but the question is a lactate meter a worthwhile purchase for your pain cave? And I would say for almost all amateur athletes, no. I think that the only reason or the only scenario where it would make sense is if you have a coach that is well-versed in lactate testing and in interpreting lactate data. And if you're at the point as an athlete where you've already nailed the basics of training and are now starting to look for the finer points of optimizing and fine-tuning your training process, at that point it might make sense. But you also have to be ready for a bit of a learning curve in learning how to even sample the lactate data yourself. It's not super easy necessarily, and I do recommend sampling from the earlobe rather than the finger, which is harder as well. So it's more of a learning curve than what it looks like on YouTube normally. So all in all, for most athletes, I'd say that no, it's not worthwhile, but there are a few exceptions. The next question is from Stoffel, who asks why and how to incorporate a VO2 master and Moxie in daily training. All right, so I have never personally used a VO2 master nor a Moxie. I have been involved in seeing them in use in some elite athlete settings, and I have also personally experimented with another SMO2, so muscle oxygen saturation device, that is not the Moxie, to be clear. So I have some experience of the actual method or the type of measurement, but not the device itself. And I do know that a lot of people say that the Moxie is the gold standard in muscle oxygen saturation. So maybe my answers are not completely reflective of what you would get with a Moxie. I think both of these devices have potential as part of formal testing in particular, going back to what we discussed already with lactate testing, that it's maybe not something to use in daily training, but as part of formal testing, they can help. I think one of the cool things about these devices is that they can help you do testing in the real world. So rather than running on a treadmill, running on a track, but with the power of a lab basically available to you. So starting with the VO2 master, obviously it is well known, and as the name implies, for measuring the oxygen consumption. So doing a VO2 max test, knowing your VO2 max, is obviously a very obvious use case of the VO2 master. I don't think that that's a very important one, because obviously you want to know your athletic profile, but you know if you have a good VO2 max or not by doing a, let's say, a 5-minute all-out test on the bike, or even something like a ramp test on the bike, like the one they have in Swift. And even though you won't know exactly what your VO2 max is, you will have a good idea of if it's good or not so good. So knowing the exact number, in my opinion, is not actionable and it's not super important, but that being said, it can be fun. But more important and maybe a slightly more actionable, maybe not super super actionable, but slightly, would be measuring your running economy in particular. Also gross efficiency in cycling, but more so I would say running economy. That is extremely important for running performance, and the longer the performance, the more important it becomes, really. And the thing that you could say about running economy is that if you have a poor running economy, then that could maybe be a sign that you would want to try to increase the volume of running a bit, increase the frequency of running a bit, and maybe adding some strength training if you already have good good volume and frequency of running. So that's something that could have some actionable impact. Cycling gross efficiency, same thing really with both the volume of training and the frequency of training and the strength training. Those would be the main levers that you can use to potentially improve your efficiency. Although the cycling gross efficiency has much less variation from person to person than running economy. And I also think that the scientific evidence for how to improve it is not as strong as for running economy. But yeah, I don't think it's hugely controversial to say that it is most likely the same kinds of things that you would do for running economy. So knowing your running economy, your gross efficiency would be a more interesting use case, in my opinion, than knowing your VO2 max. But again, this is something that can be part of formal testing, so not day-to-day training stuff. But another interesting thing that a lot of people are not aware of is that the VO2 master measures certain parameters from the respiratory system, which we actually talked about a little bit in last week's Q&A. So it does measure things like your ventilation, your respiratory frequency, etc. And this could allow you to see if the respiratory system is potentially somewhat limiting for you. So those would be the main things I would say with the VO2 master, but I would definitely look at them as these are things that could be incorporated in formal testing. It's not things that I would look at using in day-to-day training, which the question is about. Now moving over to the MOXIE specifically, or more generally, muscle oxygen saturation, SMO2. I think that the most interesting thing that you can do there is looking for the transition between intensity domains, kind of as we talked about already in the lactate testing question. Basically, based on the slope of the SMO2 curve, if you do something like a step test similar to you would do for a lactate test, then you should be able to say if you are in the moderate, heavy, or the severe domain. So in theory, SMO2 could replace lactate testing in this way, and maybe one day it will. I definitely wouldn't be super surprised if it did, because it has some advantages. It's cheaper overall because you don't have to use the test strips for every test, and it is continuous, and it can integrate with devices like your Garmin and platforms and so on. I haven't used it a lot, but from my use of it, again, remembering this is not MOXIE but another device, is that I still think it suffers a little bit from a lack of usability for being useful in day-to-day training. So you have to go into WKO or Golden Cheetah to look at the SMO2 data. It's a minor inconvenience, it's not a big deal, so I'm maybe going to give that a pass. But the main thing really is that, based on my experience, the placement can influence the readings a bit. So if you place it a little bit too far medially or too far laterally on your VL, your vastus lateralis, in a cycling test, for example, then you might get quite different readings. And I've also heard that things like pigmentation and adipose tissue thickness and so on can have a big impact there. That being said, I know that there are a lot of people that use the MOXIE and they do it with a lot of confidence in the results. So I'm not questioning the device itself, but it's just, for me, I put in more time and effort into using and understanding lactate. So for me, I have better confidence in that technology still, even though, again, on paper, SMO2 has a lot of advantages over lactate, it being continuous and not having the cost associated with lactate test strips. But this is coming from a full-time coach. I have all the time in the world, or at least I have my working week to spend on learning how to use lactate and how to use other things. If you're a normal amateur athlete that does not have that amount of time, you're not going to get something like a MOXIE or a VO2 master and be able to benefit from it without putting in significant amount of effort and time into learning it. And that amount of time, the amount of gains that you would make are marginal. So it makes more sense to spend that time, frankly, training and doing things more directly related to improving yourself as an athlete, as we'll talk about in one of the questions further below as well. But yeah, in summary, I would say that the VO2 Master and any SMO2 technology, they can be great tools in the testing toolbox, I think for formal testing in particular. SMO2, I do see the potential for use in some key training sessions because it is non-invasive, it is continuous measurement, it can integrate with Garmin computers and so on. But the devices are way harder to use than people think. And frankly, if you buy them, there would be probably a lot of time spent in frustration or just misinterpreting the data and making wrong conclusions. So I just don't recommend any athlete buy these devices. If you're curious, then seek out a coach or a lab that has them and are really knowledgeable in using them, and simply ask to pay for a test to get the data that and not having to put in the sunk cost. And it is a big sunk cost with these devices, and also all of the time that you would have to spend learning how to do it properly. It just simply doesn't make sense, and especially with the price of the VO2 Master, we're talking, I haven't looked, but last I checked, I think it's something like $5,000, whereas the Moxie would be more like $800. I think it's something like that. So I don't think we'll ever get to the point where athletes should have a VO2 Master at home. Maybe, if anything, we might get there at some point with the SMO2, just like power meters years ago used to be just not worth it for the cost, but now they are pretty much on most serious athletes' bikes. It's not to say that you can't be good without a power meter. Of course, you can be good without a power meter, but it does provide an advantage. SMO2, we might get not to the same point as power meters. I don't think we'll get there, but we might get to a point where the price and the potential benefit is at more of a balance, where for some ambitious athletes, it makes sense to have them. But I don't think we're there right now. So that would be my take. The next question is from Henry, who asks, triathletes in general seem to rely heavily on tech compared to swimmers and runners. Why? Well, I think that part of it is tradition. For some reason, probably because it was a young sport, not bound by any tradition, triathletes have always been open-minded to not doing things the way they've always been done, but challenging the status quo and see if there are ways that we can do things better. And technology is just one example of that, but it is certainly a good example. So I think that that's the main thing, that tradition of running and swimming as sports that have been established for a lot longer, and coaching practices have been passed down generation to generation, really. I do think that the open-mindedness is great, but we have to be careful and become much better critical thinkers. The more products come out on the market and the stronger the marketing claims are that we see, we should be curious, we should be interested in learning more about things that have the potential to improve our craft, but we should question things, especially when they come directly from the manufacturers. I think just to generalize a bit, but runners and swimmers probably often fall in the category of, this is how things have been done traditionally and it works, so why would we change it? Whereas triathletes, on the other hand, often fall in the category of naively and uncritically thinking that any piece of technology or any supplement or similar that comes with a somewhat plausible marketing claim will definitely make us faster. And I don't think that that's the right position to take, for sure. So I would just say that whenever we're evaluating any piece of technology, then we should ask ourselves a few key questions. So first of all, does the technology really do what it says it does? What does it measure? And has it been validated? And if so, how? So for example, let's think about Garmin watches. They tell you that your recovery time is 48 hours. Well, there's no way of measuring recovery time. What is it measuring? It's measuring heart rate recovery, some other parameters that it puts into the first beat algorithms. I'm not really super familiar with how it calculates the recovery time. It's probably not completely open source, but there probably are some white papers explaining a bit more about how they do it. But that being said, what do we know about the connection between heart rate recovery and similar corrections and recovery time? Absolutely nothing. I have never seen any evidence to show anything like that. So it hasn't been validated. So this is an example of where we really need to put our BS filter on with that kind of technology, because the recovery time, it doesn't measure it directly. So what does it measure, and is it validated or not? In this example, it is not validated. And another question that we need to ask ourselves is, is what it does or what it measures of any relevance? So I gave an example above, VO2 max. If you get a VO2 master and you measure your VO2 max, does it change your training in any way? Probably not. You know if you have a good VO2 max or not, as I said, based on things like your 5-minute power, 5 minutes pace, that and or ramp test result. So yeah, and you're not going to be using the VO2 max in training really. So yeah, thing is what we're actually measuring relevant, because we can have all the data in the world. It doesn't make us better athletes. The key question is, what is the data that can make me a better athlete? And it's probably better to be really good at using a few data channels than being garbage at using a ton of data channels. So that's a really important thing to keep in mind. A third question that I would ask myself is, in what context is the technology useful and in what context not so much? So for example, muscle oxygen saturation that we talked about above. When we look at things like the Norwegian triathletes that are using it a lot, they're doing it in different environments. They're doing it in hot training camps. They're doing it at altitude. And they're training 30, 35 hours a week. And they have a full-time coach that coaches basically two athletes. So he has the time to analyze the data of those two athletes. So in that case, yes, it can provide some marginal gains that are incredibly valuable, because the difference between winning or losing is 0.1%. So that context is completely different than what most age group triathletes are in. And in that context, the SMO2 can be a really good parameter, but maybe it's not so useful in other scenarios or in other contexts. Finally, and this is a really important one as well, is this the best use of my resources? So let's think about buying a new bike. Is that really the best use of my resources, or is the bike that I have more than good enough and I can spend a third of the money or a quarter of the money that I would spend on a new bike on doing some aero testing with a good aero testing provider and maybe upgrade some of the components on my bike, and I would actually get so much faster from that process than I would by just buying a new bike. So those are four questions that I would always ask myself when evaluating any technology. And this is where, us triathletes, we need to be better at doing these sorts of things, at evaluating claims and devices and technologies critically, rather than just buying everything that the marketing teams throw at us. All right, and the final question for today is from William, who asks, can you break down the difference in wetsuits by brand, price point, etc.? Why are some wetsuits $200 and some are $2,000? Are sleeves always better, or are they sometimes worse than sleeveless? Also, if it's within scope, it would be great to get your thoughts on how to systematically go about purchasing a new wetsuit. My current wetsuit just turned 11 and is looking a little sad, starting to get some holes in it as the neoprene wears out. I picked this one as a beginner because it was on sale and I had a club discount, but I never really enjoyed swimming in it. I feel my shoulders fatigue much sooner compared to swimming without it. Now that I'm a bit more experienced, I'd like to be more systematic for my next wetsuit. Is there any way, besides ordering a selection of wetsuits with some decent return policies and trying them on, any way to narrow down the list of wetsuits to try? So that is a really good question. Let's start with the easiest part of it, which is sleeved versus sleeveless. I recently had Professor Maria Francesca Piacentini on the podcast to discuss the science of wetsuits. And one thing that she said that the science is pretty clear on is that sleeved wetsuits are faster than sleeveless. On average, that is. But still on the individual level, if you really struggle in all sleeved wetsuits, I don't think you do because you've only tried one wetsuit really, but there are maybe a handful of people that will apply to, that really cannot get comfortable in any sleeved wetsuit, then yeah, in that case, I would say that a sleeveless wetsuit will still be faster, because if you're not comfortable, then yeah, that's going to be a big problem. And especially the longer the distance is, that could be problematic. But I would say that your wetsuit is 11 years old. Lots have changed in wetsuit technology. So you will probably easily find, even at cheaper price points, great wetsuits that are that have good mobility in the shoulder area. So I don't think this should be an issue if you find the right wetsuit, the right size and everything. You will find something that is sleeved and fits you well and is comfortable, and that will in general be a little bit faster than a sleeveless wetsuit. So this leads me to my next important point, and that is that the fit of the wetsuit is always the most important thing. You can have the best wetsuit in the world, but if it's the wrong size or just for some reason not the right fit for you, then it's not going to be a great wetsuit for you, no matter how good it is on paper or how good the technology is in it. For most people, I think that no matter the brand and model of the wetsuit, selecting the right size is the main thing, and that should give you a good fitting wetsuit. But there are certainly cases where just because of your body shape, body size, your anatomy, some wetsuits might just suit you better than others, and you just cannot find the right size for one particular model or the right fit, I should say, but another model or another brand will fit you well. So this might happen, but I think the number one level really to look at is just selecting the right size for a particular wetsuit brand and model. Obviously, the different brands might have slightly different sizing, and that's something to always look into per brand, per model, really. What about the difference in price points then? I think that there's definitely a reason that the expensive wetsuits are expensive. They use the very best materials. They have lots of sunk costs in R&D. They have hand sewing done in some parts of the wetsuits, at least, rather than machine sewing. And I can't speak for all models and brands, but generally my experience is that the expensive wetsuits are faster and feel better. But, and this is a big but, how much faster and better are they really? Well, I think that they're not so much better that anybody should feel that they have to get a $1,000 wetsuit or a $2,000 wetsuit to compete in triathlons. Of course, that's not the case. The top-end wetsuits have improved a lot, but so have the entry-level wetsuits. And for example, I have an entry-level Roka wetsuit, which at the time of recording, this sells for $295. So of course, it's not cheap, and you can probably find even cheaper wetsuits than that. But in my opinion, that is a really good wetsuit, and I would be more than happy to race in it if my high-end wetsuit, let's say, broke down. And I think I would be very marginally slower than in a top-end wetsuit. So in a way, I think that wetsuits and bikes, they very much fall in that same category, that you can have a bike or a wetsuit that is 3 to 4 times more expensive than another one, but the performance gain from the wetsuit or the bike itself is very marginal, very, very marginal, because at the end of the day, the bike isn't pushing the pedals for you, nor does it put you in a fast aerodynamic position automatically. You are the one doing both of those things. The same thing goes for a wetsuit. It might be the floatiest and most flexible wetsuit in the world with all the bells and whistles, but first of all, it has to fit you well. And secondly, if it fits you well, if you swim well, then you're going to swim well whether you have an expensive wetsuit or a cheap wetsuit. And if you swim poorly, you're going to swim poorly regardless of the wetsuit. So let's put it like this on the pricing topic. If you have $1,000 to spend on improving your swimming, including spending some of it on the wetsuit, I'd probably spend $200 to $300 on an entry-level wetsuit from a reputable brand that is good, that is a perfect fit for me, because remember, that is the number one thing. That leaves me $700 to $800, and I would probably use a good chunk of that, let's say spending $300 to $450 on joining a swim squad for 3 months. Now, okay, I'm not exactly sure about the prices here. I did Google around a little bit, and it would depend a lot on the location you are, I guess, and also the country, of course. But let's say for $300 to $450, you can join a swim squad for 3 months and get to swim with them as much as you want. But it might be just a regular 3 times a week, and that would be fine. And I wouldn't do this because it's always better to swim in a squad than to swim solo, but just because what it usually does for a lot of people is that it makes them swim more often and do longer sessions, and just swimming more, that's the number one key in becoming a better swimmer. So yeah, again, $300 to $450, $100 to $150 per month for a squad. That sounds to me like a reasonable price that you could find a swim squad for. And then we are at $550 to $700 spent, which means that I can probably, with the remaining money, $300 to $450, I can get, let's say, 2 one-on-one coached swim sessions with video analysis for the remainder of the money. And yeah, that would probably shave 5 to 10 minutes off your Ironman swim, of course, depending on where you start at. But for the typical age grouper, I would say that would shave 5 to 10 minutes off your Ironman swim, all of those things, getting that standard wetsuit and spending 3 months in a squad and having a couple of private sessions with video analysis. Whereas if you just spend all your money on a $1,000 wetsuit, then you might gain 1 to 2 minutes. So I'm shooting a bit of it from the hip here, of course. Everybody's individual. But I do think that in general, that is the trend that we would see if a lot of people try to take one of these two approaches. So I think this is a great example, actually, of how we need to think about prioritizing where our triathlon money goes. It's less about gear and more about acquiring the fitness and the skills to swim, bike, and run better. So yeah, that's what it's about. So if you're already swimming a lot and have already done lots of sessions with swim coaches to get feedback on your technique and so on, at that point, the 1 to 2 minutes saved with the best wetsuit possible could be well worth it. But yeah, if you're more of a 110 or slower Ironman swimmer, 35 or slower half Ironman swimmer, you can get more bang for your buck by spending less on the wetsuit and more on other ways to improve your swimming that I basically listed above. And yeah, the final part of the question about the process of buying wetsuits, it's not easy. I don't have any great solutions, unfortunately. If you have friends, maybe you are part of a tri club, then you could ask people with a similar body size and shape as you if they have wetsuits that you could try, and you could see if you like the wetsuit, and then you could just order that and order the same size. But that might not be possible. The other option could be, if there is a brick and mortar store locally that sells wetsuits, triathlon wetsuits, I'd suggest discussing your options with them. They might have some things they could offer. But other than that, if that's also not an option, yeah, I would just select 2 to 3 wetsuits that you think might be good for you based on reputation and reviews, and that is in your target price range, and order them to try on at home and return the ones that don't fit. It's annoying, it's inconvenient, but I just don't think there's many options to that, really. There is an opportunity here, like in the running shoe business, I think, that for some brick and mortar stores to offer shoe testing and purchase of the best pair as a combined service product. Similarly, you could argue that in wetsuits, maybe there will be brick and mortar stores that allow you to try a wetsuit on and actually swim in it and then buy it, and or do that with a few wetsuits, obviously. But sadly, I don't think that this exists much today. So yeah, it is just a bit of a hassle. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, and I have plenty of links there to related episodes, articles mentioned, and so on. So have a look there or in the podcast notes in your podcast app. If you want to improve your triathlon performance and level up to achieve your next goal, there's probably no single better thing that you can do than to get some expert help along the way. At Scientific Triathlon, we provide coaching services that cater to every need from beginners to professionals. Where the athlete is in the center, the coaching is grounded in communication and individualization, and the coaches all have a wealth of experience, knowledge, and coaching skills. If coaching is out of your budget or not for you, then we also have ready-made training plans for different athlete levels and goal events, and hundreds, if not thousands of athletes have already set big PBs and reached new performance levels with these plans. For the ready-made plans, we have exchange and or money-back guarantees, so it's a risk-free investment. You can find all about our coaching, training plans, customized training plans, and consultation options on scientifictriathlon.com. And to discuss your options, you can email me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com. And big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for electrolytes and fueling products, I would highly recommend trying them out. You can use their free fuel and hydration planner, or even get a free video consultation with the team to prepare your race strategy. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS23. And thank you to Senate. Use the Senate swim trainer to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. Even if you have just 15 minutes at home available, you can get a time-efficient Senate workout done that will help you swim better and stronger. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart. Keep loving triathlon.